midnight ride. Haunted, sacred cradle of liberty, galloping out over the grand majestic reaches of the Union, out to the last dying embers of the Republic, I'm Tom Moore.
And I'm Scott DeNito.
And you are on the Midnight Ride!
And welcome, Patriots. The Midnight Ride is a revolutionary podcast about the life and times of early colonial America, the victories and challenges and the successes and struggles of the founders and keepers of the young republic. And it's about time that you signed up at our website at www.themidnightridecast.com, where when you sign up, you're going to get access to special content because you are a special person. This is Scott, the big Minuteman here.
Three-cornered Tom.
Hey, Tom. You know, you're always busy. You recently ran into a new revolutionary character, I heard.
I was sitting there on Lexington Green a few shows ago at the Lexington Militias show, and I ran into a Mr. Michael Maresco, LibertyRider.com, and Mike is a modern-day Paul Revere.
Modern-day. You know, you interviewed the real Paul Revere while you were out there, and he was holding a modern-day cell phone.
This is the reenactor for the Midnight Ride, and he is sitting there on his horse in the middle of the night with a cell phone in front of the tourist. Too funny. The modern-day Michael Maresco, he does have a cell phone. We're about to call him. But he also, instead of a horse, he is rolling over the Grand Majestic Reaches of the Union on a bicycle.
And he is pedaling his way instead of galloping.
Absolutely. So he started at Liberty Island underneath the famous Statue of Liberty. And he's biking way over the huge, 3,000-mile distance. And he's going to end up at Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Bay.
A symbolic reference to the reason of his ride, which we'll find out right now.
Absolutely. Right now he's in Arizona, and let's call him.
I did reach you guys.
Roll
I'm
tape.
Sorry,
we rolling?
I'm sorry we never hooked up on the last one.
Yeah, that's cool, man. We've got more adventure behind under your belt now, so we're rolling tape right now. This is Tom Moore and Scott DeNito, and we've got Mike Maresco and his cross-country ride on the Midnight Ride.
Well, we have someone else here with us. Who is that, Tom?
We have a bottle of San Adams in each of our hands, and we're going to say, Mike Maresco, you are on the Midnight Ride. Huzzah!
Huzzah!
Huzzah! Welcome.
Cool. Glad to be here. Yeah, I'm pedaling a bicycle from the Statue of Liberty to Alcatraz, because that's how I think this country is headed, if we don't all stand up and do something about it.
So it's called the Ride for Honesty, right?
Yes, it is. It's what I'm playing on is that we need to face the truth ourselves. We need to stop allowing ourselves to be lied to. Everybody kind of accepts that politicians lie. It's like a cliche. Oh, yeah, well, politicians lie. Well, it doesn't have to be that way. We need to demand honesty. So, you know, the bicycle is a way of getting the message out. A lot of people will put their bicycle tire in the ocean on both sides. That's like a tradition of a cyclist. Really, I'm using it because it is just a way to stop and talk to people. People are interested in the bike. It's a curiosity.
Yeah, what kind of bike is it and how's it holding up?
It's a $250 Schwinn from Walmart.
Are you kidding me? I was going to say, did you wear the bearings out in the rear wheel yet?
Well, I did on the first ride. I wore out the front crank. The Louisiana bike shop, when they found out that I had pedaled that thing from the Santa Monica Pier, mm-hmm. they were incredulous. He couldn't even finish a sentence.
I can imagine because I'm a cyclist.
This bike isn't designed for this.
Nope. Oh no, it isn't. You know, and there's no way I could make it. I put so much torque on each downstroke that I'd tear to shreds by the time I got to, you know, Springfield, Massachusetts.
Scott, if you didn't know, the Big Minute Man, as his nickname is 6'6" tall and 330 pounds?
Yeah, about 330.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. So he's a big guy.
I'm a big guy.
Yeah, you would need a specialized bike.
Oh, trust me, I've got one, and I've broken it. So we...
I just know in my heart that this is what we're supposed to be doing.
Right. So you just kind of feel that as an American, this is what you should be doing right now for the country.
Yeah, everything, you know, it's just looking at things logically and they make sense. If people tend to make the world a lot more complicated than it really is. The Constitution is a very simple piece of paper. I mean, it can be put on a big broadsheet. It is, and it's eloquent. It's the most eloquent document governing man ever created on the face of the earth. And, you know, human nature doesn't change. The things that the Constitution addresses has not changed since civilization. The crime, the same crimes, basically, that investigators have been, you know, investigating forever are the same crimes. And that's what the Constitution addresses. The worst type of crimes is tyranny. Once you have tyranny, then you have crime on a massive scale, and true atrocities and true hideous things happen.
Wow.
So, and that's just history. That's not just American history. It's just a tyranny versus.
Well, that's like you said. That's history with, you know, around the world. That's world history.
Yeah, and on that note, so. What I wanted to say is from your ride then, and from that perspective, how stands the Union, brother? What are you finding from the people that you've been talking to across this great land of ours?
Well, I find that the people, everybody knows that there are problems. And what people are looking for is solutions. And we actually have the solutions. The freedom message is the correct solution. The Constitution is the correct solution.
It always
and
is.
Just
yep.
Reminding them that's why I ride is because I just let them know that there are lots of us out there doing this.
You know, Paul Revere named his horse Brown Beauty, but I think we forgot to ask Mike what he named his bicycle.
Hey, if we don't wake up and listen to Mike, America could be gone with the Schwinn.
Oh. Yeah, I'm going to let you get away with that now, this time.
We have tonight a co-host sitting by, daughter of the American Revolution, Ms. Karen Whalen. Karen, please say hi to our audience.
Yes, hello. This is Karen here. Glad to be here. I'm really excited to be here with these guys.
Welcome, Karen.
It's an honor.
And huzzah.
Say huzzah.
Huzzah!
Very good. And more than that, we got a real pro on tonight for a guest, I have to say. Mr. John Horgan, voice of the Boston Bruins and the New England Patriots alumni, and he's also a professional reenactor.
Well, actually, John, so I don't know if Tom had let you know, but I'm kind of big. I'm 6'6", probably about 335 pounds, you know, so I make a pretty big Minuteman. How do you compare?
Well, if you ask my wife, she put me on a diet, and I tell people to wear eyeglasses around me because I might pop a button and put an eye out. So I'm a 6'2.5", 208 on a good day.
Okay, so I still got 100-plus pounds. But anyway, so you are a reenactor, I'm hearing. Can you tell me a little bit about what got you started in the reenactment scene and what inspired you to do so? Some of the things that you really enjoy about it.
Sure. I first saw, well, we've all seen the Colonials march and parade since we were young here in New England, and I decided one day in 2005 to join the Lincoln Minutemen after seeing one of their musters, and I haven't regretted it. It's been a tremendous enrichment of my life and an experience. It's the ultimate reality show. I can't even describe how I felt. For instance, this year I was in the slot position, front rank, going over North Bridge to face off against the British. And as I saw their column come down the road, I'm snickering to myself, this is pretty cool. And then they kneel down in their firing formation, and I get angry. And then right before the firing, I was frightened. And I realized at that very moment that I had been transported back to April 19th, 17 and 75. And I imagine some 19-year-old that doesn't know his you-know-what from his you-know-what.
John had a fantastic, wonderful New England entire festival of wonderful speakers at Hibernian Hall. And John, why don't you go ahead and tell us when the 2009 New England History Festival is going to be?
Sure, Tom. It's in its third year, and I nicknamed it Historapalooza.
Wow! Right on.
Yeah, or a Colonial Woodstock.
Hey, can my rock and roll band play it?
Exactly. Or Nine Inch Nails. Or Funny Korean Actors. That's the new one that I put on. But it's basically a colonial or historical ham and bean supper without the ham and beans. If you're looking for dissertations and glasses of water and men with half moon glasses bent over microphones, this is not for you. If you're in to just see some of the best reenactors and authors in New England perform their characters or talk about their books, this is for you. So this is the third annual, Saturday, November 14th, 2009. That's Saturday, November 14th, 2009, 5 p.m., Hibernian Hall in Watertown, Mass. I'll give the phone number for tickets, 339-368-1971. 339-368-1971. The website is historyfestival.org.
So, John, you are the nation's leading expert on weather and warfare. And during the course of the American Revolution, it was really miraculous how many times the Americans were bailed out by the weather. The first sort of really unique time where the weather was perfect was when Henry Knox dragged those cannon all the way from Fort Ticonderoga in upstate New York all the way to Boston. Tell us about that.
Knox was laughed at by General Schuyler and some of the other generals, and Washington was laughed too, says, "You're going to help them." So Knox basically went out with his brother William, Billy Knox, 19 years old, 43 oxen, and he wanted to take the cannon from Ticonderoga, swing it down Lake George, so he wanted Lake George to be unfrozen for that part of the journey with the wind at his back. Then he was going to load it on sleds, take it all the way down to the west of the Hudson River, then he wanted the river to freeze so he could cross the river and cross the Berkshires, and then he cut over to Westfield to horse teams and then bring it on into Boston. And you know something? He got it.
Well, I was going to say, you're saying he wanted this. Was he actually kind of banking on it or planning that this might be the case?
He told guesswork, but he had done his homework so thoroughly that he thought that there would be snow cover on the ground, that once he got off Lake George, that Lake George would not be frozen, so he could load it into a scow, a tow, and auger these ships to bring all the cannon down, 69 pieces, 68 pieces, depending upon who you listen to, the historians or McCullough, and they're two separate and distinct entities. They got it off at the end of Lake George. They loaded it onto sledges with 43 yoke of oxen, that's 86 oxen, about 100 men, and it was a mile long, this cannon train. And what happened was Henry Knox went out ahead of the entire train, and he would secure billeting, secure rope, secure food for the animals, food for the men in the column. And so by the time that they got to Albany, for instance, and they lost, I believe it was Independence, the 24-pounder at Half Moon Ferry, half the town showed up to pull it out of the drink. So I always tell people, when you drive by Albany, raise a glass, because if it weren't for every man, woman, and child that came out and pulled them a long rope to pull Independence out of the river, that the revolution might have been lost and the cannon train might have been stalled right there and then. And they got it across the Berkshires at Monterey. Knox says something akin to, "This is the most beautiful sight that I've ever seen." And then the operation goes dark. Knox doesn't write any more diary entries. And he was a very prolific writer during the Revolutionary War, but he's suspecting that the British are onto him, even though they're not, and the word never gets out. And the operation is a complete success. They get into Framingham in mid-January, where John Adams salutes him. Mm-hmm. And then after that, it's a peculiar case, because what happens to the cannon between January 16th or 17th, well, the 19th, we'll say, and March 4th and 5th when they're deployed up on the heights. And I think that they were slowly wheeled in one at a time into Fort Washington or Fort Jackson, and before they were deployed stealthily off of the heights of Dorchester. Marvelous operation, and it had to do with the weather. If he had done it a year earlier, it would have been too warm to do it.
We have Henry Knox brings the cannon to Boston, frowning over the Four Points Channel. The British evacuate Boston. Washington knows the next place they're going to be is New York. Things move forward. We have our Declaration of Independence. By the time the Declaration of Independence gets to New York, late summer, Washington has it read. And while he has it read to the soldiers right behind him, and the soldiers are looking, obviously, they're looking the other direction, out in New York Harbor, we have an entire forest of British masts from their fleet. The biggest fleet ever ascended maybe to that time in the world, or sitting out there in New York Harbor, right?
Right. And it's an ominous sight for the colonists. They don't have a navy for all intent and purpose, and nothing that even comes close to the British strength.
Right.
And basically it's August, and maybe, Tom, you can pick it up with the battle, and I can tell you a bit about the fog, but
that's defiance. Before we get to that, to read that Declaration of Independence saying, boys, we're a new country, and this fleet be damned, you know, we're gonna fight it out here. That's backbone right there.
I call a lot of spine, as we say. Yeah, you're right about that. And in Washington, as you know, is a farmer, okay? And farmers know the weather, as was Jefferson. And a lot of these guys were farmers, and they knew the weather. They knew the New England weather well, and they knew when the wind changed that the weather would change. The British did not. The British didn't have any working meteorologists on their staff for all intents and purposes. Yeah, they had some clowns that could take the temperature and read a barometer, but that's about it.
Right.
Measure wind. But they couldn't interpret it. So
Brooklyn side, I don't know why. Okay, so if Washington is in Manhattan at that time, if you know New York is surrounded. You have the East River, you have the Hudson River, you have New York Inner Harbor, Outer Harbor, Long Island Sound. I mean, all of these land masses are like protruding out, surrounded by water. So it's a good place for a strong navy to dominate, basically, right?
Absolutely, and especially when you said the forest, 500 ships, and what they have, over 30,000 trained, hardened troops there, Marines, right?
Yes, sir, and I think that there was, now before we get to the fight, I think there was some sort of, the British thought that they could just get a treaty signed, and they didn't, wasn't there a meeting, but I think Adams and Franklin went to meet with some British envoy, and the British envoy wanted to some sort of surrender or some sort of peace mediation before the fight happened?
I'm sure. Well, if it got up to William Howe, it was probably cloaked in arrogance because, Sir William Howe was just an arrogant man. I'm sure that they were offended. I don't have the specifics here, but I'm sure that it was an overture such that if you surrender now, we'll just take everything from you and we won't kill you. It's just typical. As you mentioned, when they started landing them, the men on Long Island, the Brits, the American defensive position was tenuous at best. It was thin.
Mm-hmm.
They were underarmed, undermanned, underfed. They thought for sure that they were doomed. And they were lucky because the rain, it filled the trenches where they were, but it also impacted the British and bogged them down as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the rain in the night and the wind changed.
So in the night, that it created a temporary stalemate of sorts?
Correct. And it blew, I believe, out of the southeast. But it kept the fleet from coming up the river, too, because if the fleet gets up the river, they get any of their brigs up the river, start lobbing cannon shells onto Washington, it's game, set, match, and the revolution's over.
Wow.
Right here and then. In fact,
So the majority of the Continental Army is over in Brooklyn, basically?
Yes.
Why were they over in Brooklyn as opposed to Manhattan, Staten Island, or other places?
I don't know the tactical reason. I'm sure it was selected by Washington and his high command for a reason. But as you know, Washington had a love affair with New York and wanted to take back New York for the rest of the revolution. And his restraint in doing and not doing that, again, was one of the reasons why they won the revolution.
Right.
He wanted to attack and he never did. But I'm not sure, again, where that I'm the weather fire guy and where the exact regiments were aligned. There are far more better historians that have that tactical data than I do, Tom.
Right.
But I do know that these guys were dug in, and there was nowhere for them to go.
So for those of our audience that aren't quite familiar with New York geography, you have Manhattan, which, you know, sticks out basically like a sore thumb coming straight down north to south. It's bounded on the west side by the Hudson, on the east side by the East River. It's, in fact, an island at that time. And then you go across the East River to the east, and you're at the eastern tip of Long Island, and that's where Brooklyn is. And so basically the British came from the west, and they had them bottled in at that very extreme end of Long Island, right?
Yep.
And they had nowhere to go. Their backs were to the wall. Their backs were to the East River at that point. And like you said, it looked like the jig was up, John.
Yeah, and again, Providence plays in so many times, and not to put a religious connotation on it, and some people call it coincidence, but it was referred to in colonial days as Providence. But it rained for 3 days, and because it rained for 3 days, it, not only did it prevent the British from attacking, because again, they weren't used to the weather, they had huddled up, this was a pounding torrential rain with hail, and the British were not known for enduring heavy rainstorms or hail.
So the British, I guess, Great Britain did not have a weather system that fierce then, and still probably doesn't, I would imagine.
Well, they did, but not as frequently as it would happen in New England. My neighbor's car was destroyed by a hailstorm last weekend in Massachusetts, in Framingham.
Wow.
Oh,
mine was just about destroyed by a reckless tower, but
so John, has anyone ever, or yourself included, ever looked at the statistical probability of all of these weather incidents occurring over a period of time when they occurred, or even just one single incident occurring when it did, and deem that to be to the point where it was almost improbable? Not miraculous, just from a statistical standpoint?
No, good question. I mean, if you look at I do see these all the time, and this is why I find that weather turned the revolution. You go back to Knox, he needed some snow to drag the sledges to the ox. He got 2 feet of snow, 3 feet of snow in some places, so he could traverse, go all north to south along the Hudson River, the Mohawk River, and then he crossed. He had some difficulty crossing, some thawing there. And then when he came across the Berkshires, he didn't want snow because it was cutting over the horses, and he got that. The weather warmed, so I saw that in Knox's expedition here, where it rains for 3 days, and then all of a sudden it gets very cold at night and hot during the day, and they get this fog, which they call the heavenly messenger. And during this time,
they actually called the fog the heavenly messenger. They believe it was heaven sent.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, they already had a traveling reverend with them, of course, or several reverends, but this gave them. It gave the British no insight or foresight, I should say, to their position, because their ships were cloaked in fog in the harbor. The British position, which was literally a musket ball fire away from them, was cloaked. And it allowed Washington, because this fog hung over about 2 o'clock in the morning of August 30th over Long Island, that they could get up and get out of there.
Yep.
And retreat. And it helped.
It was a form of cover.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and there was only one escape route, and it was, I think, over the Harlem River into the mainland South Bronx. And the British followed them there and put down a heavy fire, but they were able to retreat.
Right. They got them all over. And, okay, we're in New England this year.
Well, actually, really quick.
Okay.
Just to make a little statement here, we in the U.S. right now spend, you know, multi-billions on all these defense systems. All we need to do is hire the rock band Kiss and just, you know, replicate their fog machines, right? I mean, that's exactly what it sounds like. It sounds like they had cover from fog.
Scott was formerly in a heavy metal band himself. A little biased on that one. So, John, it was actually New England fishermen from Marblehead that saved the day there at Brooklyn. They rowed Washington and his troops over in the night, in the fog.
And those fishermen would actually come in handy later on in the war when they rowed Washington across the Delaware.
I believe what happened was Washington was in the northern prong of a three-prong assault across the Delaware River. And basically they had these boats that were used to ferry goods up the river and use them as icebreakers. They were called, Durham boats.
Durham boats. And those were commandeered.
Yes, exactly.
You know, I think of icebreaking ships as something kind of more modern age. I mean, not to get too far off topic, can you briefly explain how that worked?
Well, these were manned by the experienced boatmen from Gloucester, as Tom had mentioned.
And Marblehead.
And Marblehead. And there's a passage, just, as Tom says, Washington says something kind of like breaking the passage through the ice or something like that. And they just rammed it. These guys had to break in Gloucester Harbor and Marblehead Harbor because this is in part of what was known as the mini ice age the latter half of the 18th century. So Gloucester Harbor, Boston Harbor, Marblehead Harbor freezing over was not uncommon. Today it's very uncommon and very unlikely.
I can actually comment a little on that, how an icebreaker works. An icebreaker has a very heavy and thick hull, and the heavy and thick hull will be propelled up on top of the ice, and then it presses down and it breaks the ice. The weight of it breaks the ice. And I believe, John, is this not correct, that when they were going across the Delaware, the first of those Durham boats were containing the heavy guns, they were putting the cannon in the Durham boats, so that would actually add some ballast to help break through where that ice might have been freezing over.
That's correct, and they had trouble getting those guns across. There were three crossing points, and there was a general, I forget the general, Cadwalder.
Cadwalder, like yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes. He had Pennsylvania, I believe, with him. And then General Ewing had the blocking position just to the south of Trenton. And the great guns, because of the ice, it was very cold, and Cadwalder had failed to land the artillery, so it really didn't help in the assault. And they got the men ashore to a biting, razor-sharp, sleet-in-your-face snowstorm that just fell right through your chill and bone. As I mentioned earlier, it wasn't the wind in as much as sleet. It comes down like a pellet.
It's on a winter night with a vow to defend. No retreat, baby, no surrender. John, do you know what the countersign or password was for that night?
No.
Victory or death. And that was on Washington's command. Victory or death. Their backs were up against the wall. They had gotten the tar beaten out of them in Brooklyn, again up in what is now Washington Heights of Harlem, beaten across the Hudson River and all down, kicked like a soccer ball all down through New Jersey. And basically, I guess Colonel Howe, from what I heard, was having fun with a very, very beautiful, sensual Mrs. Loring in Philadelphia. And otherwise, and he was just kind of waiting for the right time to basically offer the peace treaty, and the jig was up.
Oh, absolutely. And they were on the verge of surrender, of capitulation so many times. And in fact, when they did cross over and march in to the Hessian village, there's a number of stories. Some people say that the Hessians were loaded and they came out, half-dressed.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not,
that's
John.
That's the mainstream story.
Yes, I've studied that, and a lot of the first-hand accounts said, you know what, not one of those Hessians was drunk that morning. Mm-hmm. You know, was that Christmas morning or the day after Christmas? I'm trying to think.
Day after Christmas.
Day after, yeah. They were not loaded. They just were ill-prepared. They did. The element of surprise definitely was there, but I don't think by that morning, they might have had some drinks that night, you know, but I don't think that they were still drunk by 8 a.m.
Right. Now, the Hessians, as you know, they run you through with the bayonet. And in fact, a quick story, I don't know if you heard this, Tom, but when I participated in the Tower Park reenactment in Lexington this year with the Lincoln Minutemen, and basically it reenacts Percy, who comes to collect the scattered British column. He's the reinforcements to regroup, and he orders any snipers that are found in any house to set the house on fire. Well, Tower Park is where basically the colonists were routed until they could regroup, because Percy brought two cannons out onto the field. And I got shot because I had fallen down dead because my musket jammed. Anyways, well, a British soldier comes over to me, and he's fishing through my my knapsack, and I had hidden a potato that I had anyways in another small area of cartridges. And I said, Eschen blank to him. And he goes, I wasn't going to do it, but now I'm going to bayonet you. And he bayoneted.
Oh, my God.
So because I called him a Hessian. And
man, reenactors really get into the pillaging and all of that, too, huh?
Well, absolutely, yeah. Hessians, though, were hated by the colonists. And so there was extra vigor. They were very vehement in their attack of the Hessians. And as you know, they drove them to the orchard and in the growing daylight, and the Hessians were very they showed good military discipline.
Yes, I know that. I know that this Colonel Rall, he was especially vicious, and actually killing even surrendered American soldiers, putting them to the bayonet up at Washington Heights. As we said, you know, Washington got beat across. Even though he had the fog, he retreated to a point up above Manhattan. And the Hessians really, really put a hurt on the Americans up there and put some of them to the bayonet even after they had surrendered. They just, you know, they were very, very ruthless. And that's why Washington really, really, really wanted Trenton. You know, it was kind of payback time.
Exactly. And I believe the numbers are something on the likes of 1,500 Hessians, 500 were killed, and only a couple colonists died, and that was due to the weather. So that was a rout in a big way. And yeah, they took prisoners, as you know, and then they decided to, they were advancing, what was it, back to Princeton, where they confronted Cornwallis. I don't know if you want to move to that now, on New Year's Day, and Cornwallis, another arrogant, cocky British.
I just want to say, I want to put it up for the Irish in New Hampshire. It was, they always talk about Sullivan, yeah, okay, another Irishman from New Hampshire. Really, the fighting man from New Hampshire was John Stark. He's the one that said, live free or die. He's the one that, like, led the vanguard. All right, he was right in the thick of things at Bunker Hill. And then he had a kind of a big mouth. He told Washington, you dig these ditches, you're not going to win the war. You got to go out and fight. And Washington said what you would say to any, officer of that. Okay, you lead the way. And he did. He led the way, the vanguard, down the right along the river road at Trenton. And they were actually the first to be engaged. And then Washington was on the left, and they got to the head of Queen Street, and they set up their guns. And one of the young 19-year-old from Virginia that got wounded, that was at the head of Queen Street on that side, was a young Virginian by the name of Johnny Monroe. And of course, we know him later for the Monroe Doctrine. He was a wonderful president. President James Monroe. He was just a young lad wounded in the Battle of Trenton.
I was going to say, just a kid at that time.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Fought with my ancestors. So that's,
and he was wounded as a child there?
19 years old.
Okay.
Using that kid term
kid
loosely.
A kid from us, old person,
yeah.
Expected.
They were a lot more mature at 19 than we are, you know, in our 30s and 40s, I'm sure. But
And it ended up to Stark there. He was the one that gave a comeuppance to Johnny Burgoyne in Bennington. What was that? August of 1777. And Stark said something like, hey, if daylight, we have an hour more left, hour more of daylight, we would have whipped them completely. But there was heavy rain and bogged down Burgoyne, and, you know, that's what happened basically at Saratoga. But anyways, back to crossing now into Trenton, as you know, they finished the operation, and now they're moving towards Princeton. And all of a sudden, Washington's facing the hardest, most vicious portion of the British army led by Cornwallis. These guys are seasoned professional fighters. Outnumbered, outgunned, he has no supplies. There's been a thaw, an unseasonable thaw. Roads are muddy, untractable.
Yeah.
There's ice floes in the river. Washington's cornered.
And also, he lost a dear friend there. I don't know if you can comment on the death of General Mercer. Was lost, I know, on the way to Princeton. I forget how he got detached. He got surrounded somehow, and he was put to the bayonet, General Mercer, who was very close to General Washington. So, yeah, they did achieve some setbacks. And then I think they were able to put some guns, some cannon on the operation and turn things around, if I remember right.
What happened was he called a council of war, Washington did. And this is where Cornwallis looks through a spyglass and says, "We'll bag the old fox in the morning." I've heard it saying so many different times.
A British fox hunt, yes. Nothing more than that. You know, they were too cavalier and too underestimating of the colonists, really, the whole time, you know.
Right, and that's type of cockiness is what cost them the battle.
Yep.
And Washington noticed that the wind was blowing out of the northwest for most of the day and into the night. And it was about 49 degrees. And he said, "You know something? It's going to freeze tonight. The roads are going to freeze. I think that we're going to be able to get our cannon out, our soldiers out." And what he did is he basically did an end run around the British flank while he had a dozen or so men with campfires making an exorbitant amount of noise and leading Cornwallis and his men who were just across the river that they're still there. Meanwhile, they're retreating, and as the wind hit their footprints, you know, they're a few miles away. There was a rear guard action between the advancing British and Washington's retreating army. But again, brilliance due to the farmer, His Excellency George Washington, knew that it was going to turn cold that night, got his men packed up and ready to go, had this plan. It was something out of Alexander the Great's playbook of putting these fires, these campfires, having some brave men stay behind, making a ruckus. And the Brits think, "Oh, these guys don't even know we're here, the stupid Collins." Meanwhile, he's retreating, and he managed again to save the Continental Army, and they lived to fight another day.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you mentioned playbooks. I'm curious, Benjamin Franklin was the author of The Poor Farmer's Almanac, and did that aid or guide them at all as far as, you know, making these predictions?
Yes, in using predictions. In Monmouth, for instance, in 1778, just before that horrific battle in the intense heat, Washington knew that there was going to be a total solar eclipse, and he learned that from Franklin's almanac. And he told his command, his higher ups, saying, "Tell the men not to be afraid. There's going to be an eclipse on such and such a day, on, I believe, June 23rd, 1778, or the 24th. I don't have the date in front of me." And he gave the time, according to Franklin. Sure enough, it was. And again, that won more confidence from his soldiers. And in fact, William Rogers Clark, who I thought was Ethan Allen on steroids, who was working in the Western campaign, he told me, he knew about it and told the Indians that were giving him some grief, "Tell you what, I will darken the sun if you don't get out of my way."
God, what a unique and awesome perspective on the revolution.
I never, ever considered the weather being impacting. I guess it's common knowledge. It's common sense that it would, but I just never considered it.
And he is the nation's leading expert on that. But you'd think, okay, wow, the weather, that's a unique perspective. He also is the nation's leading expert on the aspect of fires during the American Revolution. We're going to have him back to do a show on the fires of the American Revolution. And get this, he invited us to his History Festival, and we're going to podcast maybe live from the History Festival in November, and the website is historyfestival.org.
Yep. And also, we had an email come in from Linda. Do you know where Linda hails from, Tom?
New Hampshire, live free or die. We just were talking about the New Hampshire boys.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to read this off. She says, "I really enjoyed the podcast, and I just signed up at your site." Linda, you're a role model for everyone else.
Thank you, Linda.
Go sign up, everybody. "You guys were great. Nice balance between being highly informative and educational, while still being entertaining enough to hold my attention. I'm glad that we're able to do that. I like the way you interjected questions that steered the conversation. You also sounded like you were very relaxed and having a great time tapping."
It's happening, yes.
Rewind a little bit. You're going to hear little clinks here and there. That's us.
Caps coming off.
Yeah. That's our little drinking problem that we have. So, but anyway, she finishes up with Edwin's vast knowledge on the topics that we were talking about in the particular show she must have been listening to.
I think it was Edwin and the Constitution. So yeah. We had a lot of fun with that one. Wow. Yeah.
Yep. Very well presented. Excellent job. Thank you, Linda. That is awesome. Thank you. We appreciate the fact that you appreciate us, and that's what we're here for.
Everybody else up there, sign up, become a member, and send us feedback like that. We need it. That's how we're trying to make it better.
Definitely send us feedback. You can do that by emailing us at hosts@themidnightridecast.com. Actually, when you do stop by the website, just tap that button that says Vote for Us on Podcast Alley. It's going to help us.
What is Podcast Alley?
PodcastAlley.com is a website that basically collects thousands of podcasts from all around the globe. People submit them, and it's like a little competition. You can have other folks vote for your podcast, and the more votes you get, the higher you get in their rankings. And the higher you get in their rankings, the more people find your podcast.
And you can listen to the show with a friend, and at the end of the show, you can raise your beer bottle, clink it together, and say,
Huzzah!